You're listening to the programme Saskia Unreserved on Rick Clapp.
We are now live on Facebook, streaming to you from Saskia Unreserved. I say we, my special guest, the pianist George Faux, in the studio with me, who recently won BBC Music Magazine's 2024 Newcomer Award, and who's established an international reputation as a fearless and probing interpreter of a wide array of music, combining a phenomenal technique with a profound sense of interpretive clarity. All true. A very warm welcome. Thank you so much for being here in the studio with me, George.
Thank you for having me.
Before we move to the work that you're here to play for the Pharos International Contemporary Festival, I want to go back to your first memories of the piano and what made you say, I've got to be a pianist. Was there some defining moment?
That's a very interesting question because my parents are scientists. Actually, they came to the States. I was born in the States. They knew nothing about classical music. And through following me in my piano lessons, they actually became ardent fans of classical music. And they've actually very much followed me on my journey because when I was very, very, very young, like 3 or 4, I saw a electric piano at one of the, we called a yard sale in America, but effectively, you know, it's a bunch of tchotchkes and things out laid on the lawn, and you give them $5 and you can get this.
Yes.
So apparently I stole it. Of course, it was paid for, so, you know, I wash my hands of that crime. But I was playing things by ear, and then my mom thought it would be a good idea for me to go to the local teacher. I just started that way. It was just very innocuous, and little by little, through one work after another, I became just absolutely, I fell in love with the process of learning music, the repertoire, fell in love with amazing works. And then even, I didn't really, I would say, I wouldn't think of it even as a career. It didn't occur to me to be a career until I was pretty late in my teens. And even when I decided where to go for my university, I was deciding between Juilliard or a place at Harvard. And I actually chose Harvard because I just felt I still wanted to learn other things. And even then, I was still kind of tossing it back and forth.
What were you tossing between?
A liberal arts education.
Yes.
Or a more specialized education at a conservatory.
Right.
And because I'd always had academic interests, I thought, you know, I wasn't ready to give that up. And so I still practiced all the time at Harvard. I composed, I conducted an opera, I did so many musical activities at Harvard. And then at the end, I just went, you know what, I have to stop kidding myself. I'm a pianist. So then I got a place at the Curtis Institute of Music, and then I studied at the Academy in London, and I never looked back. I'm just a pianist now. I probably was always a pianist, but it was a sort of a self-revelation.
Do you think, though, in hindsight, that all those experiences led you to this actual path? And of course, they were instrumental in what makes you the type of pianist that you are.
I think so. I think my parents were very wise in that they were very resistant to the idea of developing a prodigy. Because even though I think they sensed that I had a talent for it, they also sensed that there were so many other things to learn. And now, where I'm standing now, I can see where all of the joins are, and I can see exactly how it informs how I play and how I think about music. And I think it gives my playing a dimension that is very unique to me, and I'm very proud of that for that reason. So, again, I don't regret a single thing. It's just and I would actually encourage more young musicians to. Obviously, you must specialize, but to learn as many things as possible, because it will make its way into your art.
Do you think that this business of the niche, which is emphasized more and more, they say that you have to be part of either, you know, you're going to specialize in chamber music or you're going to be a concert pianist. Do you think that that is damaging in a way to musicians, that they lose that overall perspective, which is so important?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny you should mention chamber music, because still there are some parts of Europe and other conservatories, I'm not going to name where there are so many walls between the solo course or the vocal piano course or the chamber music course.
Yes.
And actually, that was one of the things when I studied at Curtis that was very unique to Curtis, was that most of our foundational learning of how to play the instrument, whether you were going to play concertos every single weekend, or whether or not you had were going to belong to a string quartet, your basis was on chamber music, listening to other people, learning how to react to other people. And you know what? When I play with other people and when I talk to other musicians, I immediately can sense whether or not they have that ability to think outside of, this is my part.
Yes.
I'm just going to stand and deliver. I feel very resistant to that, actually. I mean, music making is, if you are creative and open-minded and with a tiny bit of discipline and structure, it is the best way of developing your own unique voice, I think.
Mm. Yeah. It was very interesting. You left the U.S. and decided to go to the Royal Academy. Mm. You're now lecturing, teaching there. What led to that move? Was there somebody specific whom you wanted to study with?
Yes. I mean, you know, I studied with Chris Elton and Joanna McGregor at the Academy, and they were really just, it was exactly what I needed at that point in my development. And they're fantastic teachers, not just great teachers, but they knew when to push and when to let go. And I really appreciate them now.
Oh. I just want to pick up on that. Yeah. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
To push and to let go.
Yes.
So rare,
yeah,
isn't it? The letting go part, especially with teachers. They know how to push really hard often.
Yes.
But the letting go isn't a very important part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you elaborate a little on that?
Yes. Well, I think the mark of a very efficient teacher knows how to communicate a message, but often it comes at the risk of students from a studio sounding the same. And actually, yes. I find it interesting that if you go to the Academy and you listen, I think all the faculty are wonderful. Everybody sounds different. And I think that is something to celebrate. You know, I have, and it's something that I think about when I'm teaching, you know, I have my approach, but really it comes down to helping the student find what works best for that particular artist and letting them find their way to what they want to hear, not necessarily what you want to hear. And that really requires a high level of empathetic skill.
Yes.
It also requires just experience listening to a lot of different people, a lot of different concerts to see what their approach may be. Yeah, and everybody has something. I think if you're, you know, especially at a place like the Academy, everybody has something very special to offer.
Yes.
So, you know, you're not necessarily thinking about, I've got to give them a bunch. I mean, they're already there. You're just there to give them shape, a little bit of structure, and then push them on their way,
right,
I think.
Right.
So,
you worked intensely on the music of Messiaen and Debussy, and I wondered, what is it that drew you to these composers specifically?
Messiaen and Debussy. Yeah. Specifically, I have a special interest in the music between 1900 and 1945.
Yes.
Maybe to 1950, especially around France, because France is, at the time, especially Paris, is one of the real cosmopolitan centers. It's one of the places where if you were from elsewhere, you could move to Paris and you could actually just write the way that you wanted to write. And of course, there was less resistance there than in other places. And so, you know, it's interesting. Stravinsky was there.
Yeah.
Debussy was there. Ravel was there. There was the, you know, the Ballet Russe. There were, if you speak of Ravel and Debussy, you know, these, their exposure to the gamelan music, to the music of Asia, it was there. I mean, when else in history before that were you going to be able to hear all these different influences in one place?
Mm.
And so basically, for that reason, you start to see, at least in the repertory, a kind of cleaving of different styles. And it's that cleaving, I think, combined with the fact historically that we were about to enter an era of intense tragedy and bloodshed and political turbulence. That intersection interests me so much, both like sociopolitically, historically, but then also the music that's coming out is filled with these amazing stories and narratives and approaches. And so Debussy and Messiaen, they're just two notable composers there that belong to a particular tradition. And, you know, personally, I find, like myself, I have an affinity for that kind of music, that kind of playing. But in general, this is, you know, this, there's a whole context here which fascinates me.
Yes. Yeah. Messiaen's language is intensely personal, emotional, informed by a deep Catholic piety. His time in prison in 1940 resulted in the quartet For the End of Time. His return to the Paris Conservatoire in 1943, where he focused on the piano with a musical language that is so much his own. What is your approach to it?
That's a very good question. I could write a lot about that. Well, I'll maybe take a step back from just to see that, you know, you speak on Messiaen and his religiosity.
Yes.
For me, because I'm also a composer, it interests me a lot in how a composer will think, how they think of the building blocks with which they want to work, and how it meshes with their sensibility toward music and what they want to express. So I think it's when people think of Catholic faith, I think it's often very different from Messiaen's sense of Catholicism, because he was obviously very devout and did all the services, but he also he was interested in other religious cultures as well as the natural world. And for him, faith is more of I read it as a sort of nihilistic approach to religion, not kind of the collectivist idea that we have now, but more like we are all going to die. And I mean, obviously he was living in a time where there was death everywhere around him. And there's this little special corner in time, because time and eternity is everywhere in his music. And I want to express that contradiction. And for him, love is such a big part of his musical language. And love for him is something filled with fear, awe. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, Kierkegaard's writing on religion, which is, to be faithful is actually a radical act. And so therefore, you know, even though he writes in a very constructed language, there are chords, there are scales, but it's this kind of pushing that like feeling of eternity into these structures. And it sort of it brims over those structures. And so when so you have to kind of embody that paradox, you know, it's very, when you play, it has to be clear, but then you also have to give the sense of too much, especially, you know, when Messiaen feels happy, it's not just happy, it's joy and ecstasy. When he feels love, it's this tremendous tenderness.
There's a very wide range of emotions.
And it's always
and very
in
intense.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's always in its extremes. And for that reason, it's you know, you have to be very fastidious, because he's incredibly detailed with how he writes. But then after that, you have to forget everything. You have to forget everything. All that fastidiousness was for the practice room. And then when you get to the stage, it's just, you know.
Is that when you're not so much a composer? You don't look at the work as a composer, but you become the pianist?
Yes.
Because
there
must be a little conflict.
There is.
In a way.
There is. It's funny also that you should mention that, because my favorite pianists were also, the ways that they interpreted were not so far differentiated from composition. My favorite pianists, Courtauld, Busoni, Rachmaninoff, these people.
You've really gone back.
Yeah, I've really gone back. But it didn't used to be such a cleavage from composer to interpreter. You know, I mean, obviously they had their the ways that they went too much.
Yes.
But I think the general sense was that I'm not just an executant. I'm not shutting down my ego completely. Obviously, you have to give respect to the score, but respect does not mean complete, supplication to the score. And I think that's very important, especially if you're going to be playing this music nowadays. I think this is a trend where I see a lot of your artists in my generation, they're starting to move more into this direction, actually. So when I think about when the composer, it's more of like a gradient than a full stop.
Right.
Yeah.
The work that you're going to perform tonight, the 20 Contemplations on Infant Jesus, was written in 1944, dedicated to his wife, Yvonne. She was also quite an experimental composer. Do you believe that they influenced one another?
Absolutely.
And in what way?
So at the time he wrote this piece, he was not yet married to Yvonne Loriot.
Thank you for clarifying.
No, but it's okay, because it is his wife, just not at the moment that he was writing. But he had just written Vision de la Mène for her, which he played with her. And I think it's also interesting to note that this was around the time where his then-wife, Claire Delbeau, started to lose it. She had a deteriorated mental state that was, it ended in catastrophe late in his life. And I think, the echoes with losing his mother early in life, you cannot help but see that. So Yvonne and these sort of musical explorations, I read a lot of it as sort of a refuge from that tragedy that was greatly unfolding, because he loved Claire so, so, so much. And, Yvonne, he writes that basically she set him free because she was she had prodigious technique and she had such a mind for the way that they wrote. So it was really a musical match that later developed into romance after great tragedy in his life.
Yes.
And I think, again, that context is extremely interesting when you look at how this piece unfolds.
Mm. Mm. I was quite interested to hear some of her works as well.
Yeah.
Very interesting. The length of the work is phenomenal. It's 2 hours.
Yes.
It's a stretch for you.
Yeah.
And it's a stretch for the listener too.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the challenges, and are there easy parts as well? I thought, so often I ask about challenges and what it is about the piece that draws people. To play, not necessarily only this work, other works as well. But there's some things that just flow in it and that come easily as well. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, when you prepare a work like this, you have to prepare it piecemeal. But now that I've finished preparing it and I've studied it, I see that it is essentially a set of 20 tableaus.
Yes.
And if one can give the sense of 20 tableaus rather than 20 pieces of music that are just going to hit you in succession, it helps build a narrative arch that is why when you sit through, for example, the Ring Cycle in Wagner, it goes by like that. And actually also when the theme comes back at the end, and this is something that a lot of great composers have in these, at the end of the huge cycles, you see the Goldberg Variations at the very end,
yes.
The theme comes back. And it's very similar here. The theme comes back at the end, and you have to have gone through all of that journey for that last return to have made it the kind of impact that he makes. Remember, he's talking about things about time, eternity, love, faith. And so I think the way I see it is that you present a theme at the beginning, you go through this wonderful journey, and at the end, when the thing comes back, when you notice the same thing, but you've changed from the experience of going through it, it's incredibly moving. I don't know how else to describe it than that. You have to just experience that.
It's not only one leitmotif, though.
Yeah, it's
really
several. It's several
themes. There are quite a few.
Several
themes. Can you elaborate on what they are, and how does that help the listener to place? Because they hear them and it comes back.
Yes.
To place them, in the entire structure of what you're listening to.
Absolutely. I think anything that helps, particularly if it's a listener for a piece like this for the first time, they need as much signposting on these themes as you can give them.
Yes.
And here, I see it right now in front of me. There's the theme of God. This is the theme of the star and the cross.
Yes.
There's the theme of the chords. And he even writes here, it's meant to kind of be in a rondo form. So the themes appear in a particular kind of a series. And these composers are clever people. They know why these events happen in this order. I also find that with this piece in particular, because unlike Beethoven and Bach, where you kind of have to go into their letters or their diaries to figure out what their motivations are. He actually writes, you know, this is this thing happening. This is this tableau happening. And each of them has a very specific story.
Yes.
Often it's made up and it's mystical. But if that tableau is there, then it just frames everything in a really wonderful way. Yeah.
Do you believe the audience needs to be informed prior to coming to the concert, for example, this evening? Should they have done some reading? I hope they've heard your words of wisdom. Yeah.
Well, I don't think they need to do reading, actually. I just think all that you need... I mean, look, when you go to a restaurant, you see what the menu is and you know what you're going to get. I think it's just as simple as that. You don't need to go into saying, oh, like... I mean, obviously, as much context helps, but in my experience, it's just a tiny little frame around this musical content. And honestly, a good piece is one in which you don't need any of this stuff and you'll still be able to get. And I also think a good performance is one that conveys that. But nevertheless, you will get more out of it if you know.
I want to play the one section that you've actually selected. It's the 11th variation, movement, should we say?
Yeah, movement
rather. Why did you select that one?
The 11th one is the first in the second half. So you have 10, and I play it with a break. Most people play it with a break.
Yes.
At the 10th, at the midpoint. And the 11th is the return. And it's titled The First Communion of the Virgin, Première Communion de la Vierge. And it has the theme of God in the left hand in chorale form, and it has these streaking constellation like quick figures in the right hand coming down. And it gives a really nice introduction to the kind of sonic world that Messiaen has, which is very coloristic. But I think it's just beautiful, and I think it will explain itself in its innocence and its tenderness.
Let's listen to that now.
Thank you.
We've just heard the 11th movement, the Virgin's First Communion of Messiaen's work, 20 Contemplations on the Infant Jesus, played by Håkon Østbø, the Norwegian pianist. And I'm wondering, there wasn't a recording of you playing this. I didn't find one. Have you recorded it? Is it on the plan?
It is on the plan. It is on the plan. When you commit something to recording, you got to live with it for a long time. I think with a work like this, it's a bit like recording the 32 Beethoven sonatas. You have to do it when you are ready to say, this is, when I die, this is what is left of me. I think that's the plan.
Right.
So I will record it at some point.
You will record it. How does it feel listening to Håkon's interpretation? Does it bring other thoughts about?
Yeah, I mean, I love this interpretation of it. Actually, immediately I identified it. I was like, I think this is Håkon's recording of it. It's a wonderful recording. I mean, he has such efficient and intelligent pianism to it, but the pacing as well. He really just gives space to everything, so you know exactly what's happening, and there's a clarity, but never at the expense of the feeling. It's full of feeling. It's really fine recording.
And I just feel that it forces one to slow down.
Yes, yes.
We live such a fast-paced life, and I think that this is a work which really forces one to take a step back, think, and just let the music wash over.
Just be, because, you know, I mean, yes. Most of us are glued to our devices these days.
Yes.
We have an attention span of about 2 seconds. And, you know, I think, isn't it like, you know, on the Instagram, when you scroll through the thing, if it doesn't catch you in a second, they want you to keep scrolling. But this piece, and actually many great works of art, force you to just, you know, take that aside, put that monkey brain aside, and just, you know, live with just what it feels like to be and to listen and experience. And this work does that, truly.
China plays a huge role on the world's musical stage, and its wholehearted acceptance of Western culture since the end of the repressive Cultural Revolution in 1976, so which is nothing really short of eye-opening. We see estimates of about 50 million Chinese studying music. 36 million of them are piano students. And Robert Sirota, the president of the Manhattan School of Music, remarked in 2007, so back then, that, and I quote, "The future of classical music depends on developments in China in the next 20 years. Looking now at 2024, what are your thoughts
about that? Well,
were any of the predictions correct?
Look, there's a lot of concert life going on in East Asia right now. A lot of fine artists are bringing world-class performances there. In many ways, there's support for classical music that you could only financially dream of over there. And it's also no mistake that if you have a culture that values hard work and practicing, and that you just throw a bunch of talent at facilities and institutions designed to foster this, you're going to get a crop of very, very fine musicians. And they're also going to create an audience. And I think it's something to remember here if we want to hang on to that tradition. Absolutely. Look, I think that the more people listening, the better. I don't really care where they do their listening, because I think this, what we have here, is truly just, it's the reason why I'm alive and I want to just play and share. I think there is actually quite a lot that they remember there that we should probably pay attention to in terms of preserving this culture here. That's kind of how I feel about it.
You mean a European culture?
Yes, specifically European classical music of this particular notated tradition, concert music, the importance, and they feel like it is worthwhile investment.
Why do you believe that that approach has been taken. And yet, if you look at culture in Europe, we see so many orchestras closing down, mm-hmm. Music schools not surviving. As you said, you know, if you're scrolling and
yeah.
you don't, something doesn't capture your attention immediately, it's gone. Why do you think that is?
That's a very interesting question. There's a lot of reasons. And like this, it's like the minute you start pulling on a thread, the whole sweater comes undone.
Yes.
I do think there has been an abdication of responsibility in terms of people wanting to really, truly support art here. And the kind of art that, you know, values excellence, values the sort of dedication and hard work, and also values, you know, there, art is, my friend and I, Mahan Esfahani, this past weekend, we were talking about how arts and the humanities, it is a moral education. It is actually, I mean, fundamentally, the Greeks believed this, and I still believe this. It is a moral education because it forces you to stop and you think critically. And for whatever reason...
He has some very profound thoughts on music and education as well.
Yeah.
I've been privy to them. So
yeah. Honestly, look, when I started playing the piano, it was this Texan lady named Carol Krewalt who just said, the basics are you just got to sit down, practice, put the metronome on, and she just had this rolling studio of very diverse backgrounds. One of her ex-students is now a leading professor and exponent of African-American music. She's got me. She's got another pianist out there playing a lot of music out in America. So, but, you know, her studio was not a fancy studio. It doesn't take... It is not rocket science. It is just get a bunch of kids in there, turn on some metronomes, throw on some pianos at them, throw trumpets at them, throw mm-hmm. them in orchestra. They'll love it. And that is a moral education. I think it just gives you something that nothing else can really give you. You know,
what is about the influence of the parents on the whole schooling?
I have a daughter as of 4 months ago. I think about this a lot now. Thank you. I think about this a lot now. And I think...
That's quite a profound moment, I think, to become a parent.
But then when you say, you know, education, you know, what I want to give her, these sort of things in terms of schooling is not the ability to learn rote tasks. Schooling is the ability to think clearly, concisely, and for yourself. And I think this is something that... many governments should just keep in mind. You know, you've got to have a populace who can take information and think about it critically, not just go for whatever, you know, headline comes in and just catches your... No, you have to have... Otherwise, everything that we have, democracy, humanities, it just falls apart. And I think that is really the... That's why I think it's a moral education. All of this, you know, it's all connected.
How do you believe that governments should go about this?
If I knew, I'd run for office, but
yes.
I can't.
No, I think that yeah. I hear so many wise words here,
yeah.
and I just don't know why it is that we don't have politicians who encompass these thoughts, why they don't listen. Okay, so does it all boil down to financial gain?
Maybe. I mean, on some level, I have some sympathy for certain politicians because, honestly, there are so many competing needs and the world, everybody needs cash right now. That
yes.
is just the reality of life. That being said, I think if you don't value humanities and the arts appropriately, you just don't think of it as a worthwhile investment. And you have to remember, this investment is not something that will pay you next year. This is something that lays the foundation for a stable democracy mm. for decades. And that is just, I just think it's just so easy to forget if we do not keep on pushing that message forward.
Do you see at the Academy a 10-year plan? Have they got a 10-year plan that's in focus
the Royal
that
Academy.
You...
I wouldn't know about it. However, I will say...
if you don't know about it,
yeah.
isn't that part of the problem? That, for example, an institute like that, the people who are there driving it forward. People like yourself should know that this is our ideal. This is where we want to reach. We want to have, you know, 10,000 people sitting, listening, for example, to the concerts of our students, or we want to develop. I mean, I'm not talking about making a bigger academy. Hmm. I'm seeing a long-term impact based on what you've said.
Yeah. I mean, I actually do think in what you're speaking of, a lot of institutions are like the academy are actually, they do have that very firm,
vision.
Very, very firmly in focus, particularly for the next few years. I mean, I was speaking with the head of piano earlier, and she it's a tough job. You have to recruit students, but then you also have to try to give them the tools that will make them be effective musicians in the 21st century. And I think, you know, an educational institution like that, some people think it's not enough now at an institution like that to just teach people to play well. And I actually think that's true now. I think a lot of it is in reading, in academic work.
Yes.
In thinking. I mean, if we're talking about, because the fundamental role of the institution, I think, is to put out good graduates that will change the world. And I think in that aspect, good humanities program attached to conservatories, just a lot more reading, a lot more playing in communities. So you actually see people being touched. I mean, this morning we just played for Faros has a wonderful educational initiative. We played for, I think it was school age students in their teens, and they, you know, I played this stuff to them. They were transfixed. And I told Garo, who runs the foundation, like, if I don't do this, I don't know where else they would have exposure to. And it's really, it's not rocket science. It's just little bits of exposure. Obviously, we're not asking for everybody to go out and be a concert pianist. We're just asking
them
to.
No, we want to develop some kind of listeners and, as you said,
Literacy
and critical thinkers and active citizens.
Yes.
And this cannot happen if they don't have a spherical outlook and education. So I'm in complete understanding and agreement with you. And we've just played this excerpt of the 11th movement. But that's not the same as listening to you playing it tonight at the Pharos. That connection of a live concert or a live educational, that's why probably the most important part of your visit here was done this morning.
Yeah, in some ways the most impactful in terms of maybe the butterfly effect of, you know, you play once and then they will then go. I mean, I already had a student this morning say, you know, when is the concert? You know, when are tickets? You know, that's it doesn't take much.
Yes.
Just one convert, as you said, just one convert.
Touching on the teaching at the academy, there are so many students you mentioned earlier that they're all supremely talented. What will happen to those who don't make it? Do you think about that? Do you have any way of talking to your students about that? Because they're not all going to become concert pianists. It's simply the statistics indicate that, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I was speaking a little bit about that this morning as well. Look, it depends on what you define by making it. And this is one of the things that I had to come to peace with when I decided, right before I went to Curtis and I said, this is my life. Because I had to contend with the fact that if I was a local teacher in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a lovely place in the United States, and I had this rolling studio, I would be a happy man in doing that. And occasionally I would have recitals, and occasionally I would have my chamber music partnerships, and that would be worthwhile to me. And I think every single person that comes into the academy has already made that decision, that whatever happens, they are happy with a life in music. And obviously you want to give them as many tools as possible. Look, making it, Bach was a church organist for his entire life. He was one of the greatest artists that ever graced this earth. So really, like, if you're flexible and you put out work that's worthwhile, that's really the point of a place like the Academy, I think. Yeah.
Among the older generation of pianists, apart from Busoni and Rachmaninoff, who else do you admire?
Do I admire from that generation? I mean, I've become recently completely obsessed with Ignaz Friedman and his playing of the Chopin mazurkas. You know, there's a story, apocryphal story possibly, about Chopin playing mazurkas, and I think it was Kalkbrenner saying that it's not in three, you're playing it in four. And actually, Friedman does it, but when you do it like that, it just gives such a verve and panache. You know, Benno Moiseevich, I love his playing. Solomon, Horowitz. I mean, these were the guys that I think really brought me to this profession. I mean, there's so many fantastic pianists nowadays. I don't mean to exclude them either.
Right.
But, you know, those are my guys.
Those are your guys. What about audiences? Where do you think that you can find the best listeners?
The best listeners?
You've been around the world?
The best listeners are in Cyprus. No, but really, I think...
Diplomacy will get you everywhere.
A good audience... You know what? I can't speak to the best audiences, but I think my... In some way, places... Some ways, my favorite audiences are audiences for which I play a really heavy work in the middle of nowhere, and you don't know what's going to happen, and I always get surprised. Actually, I just played a trio concert with my trio Zimbalist in, I think it was Red Hook, New Jersey, and it was this auditorium in this church hall, and we pulled up and we said, we don't know what we're going to expect here. And wouldn't you know it, small town in New Jersey, everybody acted like they listened well, they loved everything, they really listened. So you really, I have learned to suspend all expectation about where I'm going to find a good audience, you know, so.
It's been our privilege to have you here in the studio. Thank you so much for coming, Mr. George Fuhr, pianist, and we're looking forward to your performance this evening of Messiaen's 20 Contemplations on the Infant Jesus.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.